If you don't understand, if you're not empathetic about your readers, your customers, whoever, well, you're going to start to lose out to people who aren't.
Write the world-changing book that will help grow your personal brand and your business as it makes the world a better place. Welcome to the Author's Corner, hosted by Robin Colucci. Every episode, we bring you some of the most successful authors, as well as other industry experts, to share some inspiration, motivation, tactical strategy, and fun. We'll also talk about the challenges and trends in the publishing industry. Don't get stuck in the idea phase. Join the Author's Corner today. Start writing the book you've dreamed about.
Hello and welcome to the Author's Corner. I'm your host, Robin Colucci, and I'm going to open up today's show with a question. Why is it that some messages are successful and others aren't? The answer is simple, but it's not easy to do. And today's guest, Ben Gutman, is going to give us the answer. Now, Ben is a marketing and communications expert and the author of Simply Put, Why Clear Messages Win and How to Design Them. He's an experienced marketing executive and educator on a mission to get leaders to more effectively connect by simplifying their messages. Ben is a former co-founder and managing partner at Digital Natives Group, which is an award-winning agency that worked with the NFL, I Love New York, Comcast, Hachette Book Group, Nature Conservancy, and many other major clients. Currently, Ben teaches digital marketing and also consults with a range of thought leaders, venture-backed startups, and other brands. So in this interview, Ben shares with us some of the design principles that enable us to communicate clearly and build trust with our readers. Enjoy. So, Ben, welcome to the Author's Corner.
It's great to be here, Robin. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's a pleasure to have you. And your book, Simply Put, is actually a pretty new release just last month, really. Or no, actually, now it's almost 2 months because now it's December 1st today. And, you know, I am a firm believer in having a simple, clear message. One of my former business coaches, who was probably, if not the best business coach I had, used to say, a confused mind says no. And so how could you add to that statement in the framework of what your expertise is?
Oh, yeah. I mean, that's a great sentence. I love that. I'm gonna steal that a little bit, some of the stuff that I'm working on. But yeah, I mean, so I ran this marketing agency for 10 years. And one thing that was the commonality that we would see between clients that were successful, projects that were not doing as well, was that, well, when you are able to communicate in a way that is simple, clear, and is empathetic with the listener, with the reader, then they're going to be successful. And the ones that have the stuff that's kind of locked up inside of them, but they can't really reach out across the way from being a sender and putting themselves in the shoes of being a receiver, well, they're not going to be as successful. Mm-hmm. And even after we sold the business and I, you know, no longer was working on a day-to-day basis with the same types of clients, that question still stayed in my head, which is, well, why is it that some of these are successful and some of these aren't successful? And it turns out that the answer was simple. And that was literally the answer, but that doesn't mean that it's easy, right? And so communicators that were more effective were simple. The ones that were less effective were often more complicated. And if that was enough, then I wrote this on the first page of my book. I said, if that's enough, then, you know, don't buy the rest of the book. Don't read the rest of the book. But the other 207 pages are kind of examining, well, what does that really mean? And how do we achieve that?
And like you said, it's not that it might be simple, but it's not necessarily easy to be simple in our language.
Oh, yeah. And what's funny about that, too, is that when you look at what does it mean to be simple, well, it means that something is easily perceived, understood, and acted upon. And if you ask a cognitive scientist, well, what does that mean? They'll say it's fluent. And so the word fluent is something that, you know, you and I know because we're fluent in English or Spanish or Mandarin. But if you ask, again, the scientist, well, the fluency describes how easy is it to take something from out in the world, stick it in your head and make sense of it. And the things that are easier, that take kind of less mental work, well, we like them more, we trust them more, we buy them more. And the things on the other side, the things that we have to sweat over, you know, kind of takes more mental processing power. Well, we don't like them, we don't buy them, we don't trust them. And so whenever we're in a position of messaging, we always kind of want the former, right? We always want the people to like us, trust us, purchase us, choose us. And so that's why it's so important for us to get there.
Yeah, that's all very well said and very true. Now I'm really torn, Ben, because I want to dig into that, but I also don't want to step over something you said right from the beginning that I think is so vital and such a vital piece of what you're sharing, which is this empathy piece. And so say more about that and how that plays a role even inside of the simplicity.
Oh, yeah. So when we look again at what is it that we want as a receiver, and whether it can be a reader, a buyer, a voter, a donor, whatever it is, we're a receiver. And then there's senders on the other side of the equation, right? That's advertisers, authors, advocates, whatever. Receivers want fluency. Senders have a really hard time getting there because there's forces inside our heads, in our society, outside, that are trying to always kind of push us towards complicated, pushing us towards more. And one of the ways which we can bridge that gap, and the book is organized in the second half, I have five design principles that help us get, you know, closer from those two parties. One of them is empathy. And empathy is about both kind of speaking in the language of your users, of your readers, but also, I mean, the literal language, but also meeting them where they are emotionally, where they are in their motivations, and understanding them and as the most important part of the equation, and going from there instead of saying, oh, it's all about me and what I have to say.
Okay, since you brought up the chapter, I have to ask you, so the name of the chapter is actually Empathetic, Welcoming the Enlightened Idiot. So would you care to help us understand how you define enlightened idiot?
Yeah, and so the enlightened idiot is, you know, whenever you're writing a book, you want to make sure that you're grabbing somebody by the lapels and making them understand what we're talking about. An enlightened idiot is a really good clarifying piece of this, which is, idiot, by the way, is a term of endearment here. It is,
of
if you
course,
look at the origins
so.
Of that word, yeah, it's the common man. And that your audience. Enlightened means they know something that you don't, right? And so that's what I'm trying to say, which is that enlightened idiot is all of us when we're outside of our element, outside of our bubble. And I would put on that hat all the time when I would be working with a client, and the best marketers I know are just, you know, not afraid to be kind of stupid, right? Not afraid to ask a dumb question, because that's how you get past that wall that people put up. I remember sitting in we were working with an energy company once, and I was sitting in this conference room with like 20 people, this big stakeholder interview I was doing. And I just asked them, like, well, what do you guys do? Right? Like, and just like a stupid question like that, and having them explain it in their own words, and then asking a bunch of, you know, enlightened idiot follow-up questions helped me understand what they did, why it was important, and how to communicate that to the audiences that they actually care about, that project was about. The biggest thing, we have a really hard time as just anybody, as people in marketing, as people in business and just life, is that we don't like to get feedback. We have a really hard time going out and asking people what they think about something, because often that ends up being, the answer might be something we don't want. And then number two is also, it's awkward in the process a lot of times, right? You got to go, you know, talk to a stranger, you got to go flag them down somewhere in the street. But that is the single, like, most obvious way to kind of break through this. It's like the no duh piece of this, but it's the thing that everybody is going to ignore.
Well, that's like a whole nother point. It's making me, of course, think of parallels to writing a book. And one of the things that I keep hammering into my clients is that you have to write in such a way that the reader feels seen, right? But not like you're telling them what they think or feel, because then their subconscious mind is going to push back and say, you don't know me, you know. You can allude to it, but you can't say, I know this is what your experience is. So I'm just seeing parallels there, but.
Oh, yeah. Well, I mean, it's 100% true. I mean, the version of that also is, you know, I was listening to another conversation you were having on an earlier episode, and I forget the gentleman's name, so I apologize. But he's talking about, well, it's writing for one person, right? Like, what is the one person that you're writing for? This is the biggest trap that people fall into in writing a book or in writing like a marketing email, is that they think, well, this email is going out to 100,000 people. So it's me standing on a mountaintop talking to 100,000 people. But that's not actually how the other half of the equation experiences it. They're one person getting this one email. For them, it's a one-to-one relationship. And actually, in every situation that we do mass communication, it's a one-to-one relationship. There are crowd dynamics and, you know, mob mentality, these other things. But in most situations, if I'm standing there in the stadium and there's a, you know, politician giving a rally, it doesn't matter there's 50,000 other people there. That's one person on that, on the speaking side, and I'm one person in my head when I'm hearing it and I'm understanding it. So crowds don't really exist. Like, that's an important piece to kind of get around.
Yeah, brilliant, especially with the empathy piece.
Oh, yeah. And you know who's before we move on from this one, you know who's the best at doing this, by the way? And she doesn't have a book yet, but I'm sure she will at some point, is Taylor Swift. So
interesting.
I don't know if you watched her concert movie or saw her show anywhere. My wife's a big fan. I enjoy her. I think she's very talented, but I'm not as much of a Swiftie. But I went to the movie, and she's able to pull off this magic trick that nobody else is as good at her right now about doing it, which is you can stand in front of 70,000 people and make every single person in that audience feel like she's talking just to them, that it's just to one person, both in the lyrics to her songs and the banter on the stage and through space and time of being recorded on a movie and being shown in thousands of screens across the country. That is something that is a rare talent. And it's because when you think that you're speaking to one person, when you internalize that, well, it changes the entire framing of what comes out of your mouth.
Yeah. And it also changes like the energy that the communication rides on too. It's more intimate.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, and the other example that I like to cite famously, like Bill Clinton, you know, when you look back at his campaign speeches, how he campaigned in the 90s, people always talked about that, which is that he makes you feel like you're the only person in the room.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It really is a consistent trait of great communicators. And I think I've noticed that too. I mean, probably not to the degree that you just described with Taylor Swift, but it's amazing how you can see a performer who's very technically fine, but they don't move you internally, and even see like another performer who might not even be technically as good, but you're just completely carried away by their performance. And I think that could be applied to other.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
So the empathy piece is clear, that you have to make the person feel seen, but at the same time, not make assumptions. Would you agree with that? Or would you put that another way?
I think that's important. I think that I joke that there's like the novelty coffee mug, which like if you assume, it's like you make an ass out of you and me, right? And while coffee cups and bumper stickers are not always the best source of wisdom, that's a pretty good one. A lot of us, actually all of us, fall prey to the same bit of psychological trickery, which is known as the false consensus effect. Which effectively what that is we believe that our opinions, our motivations, our preferences are representative of the world, a representative of the whole population. We're pretty much average. We pretty much are in the middle. We pretty much, you know, understand everybody because we represent them. And this is broadly not the case. Like, you know, this happens, you know, here's an example. Like maybe my favorite ice cream flavor is Mint Chip, right? And I would say, well, I'm a pretty normal guy. Most people probably like Mint Chip also. And so I might think the distribution is, well, it's, you know, 75% Mint Chip and it's 25% whatever. But in reality, it's probably the opposite. It's probably something completely different. And this happens in, you know, people like chocolate or they like strawberry or cookie dough, whatever. And this happens when you look at ice cream. This happens when you look at politics. This happens when you look at business, is that we over and over again will overestimate how much our opinions represent everybody else's. And furthermore, how much our experience of the people around us, well, everybody I know is voting for so-and-so. Everybody I know uses this, you know, brand of shampoo. Well, yeah, everybody you know also like went to the same college and lives in the same city and you know, is the same, you know, what goes to the same house of worship or whatever it is. And so, yeah, you're not representative of the entire world. You're representative of your small bubble that you're in.
Mm-hmm. And that seems to be more of an issue now than ever in terms of communication.
Oh, yeah. And it only gets worse, too. I mean, there was a famous study not terribly long ago about Facebook networks and how much, you know, most people on Facebook, you know, billions of people, you know, all around the world, every ethnicity and political orientation or whatever. Well, it turns out most conservatives were friends of conservatives. Most liberals were friends of liberals, right? Like, and that applied to a lot of other metrics as well. And so it's easy to kind of fool ourselves into thinking that we know how other people speak and think because we tend to, again, hang out in groups. It's called, the phenomenon is called homophily, right? We tend to just be with other people that are like us. And it's usually not really intentional. It's usually the result of some sort of other upstream factor like education or geography. But it ends up being something still that does color our perception and makes us oftentimes unempathetic with the listener, with the reader.
Yeah, because if everyone around you has an opinion and we all think we're all very smart, then we just are going to assume that everyone who doesn't share our opinion isn't, right?
Oh, yeah. And we also, this goes to another kind of like trick of the brain, too, which is we like to think we're a lot smarter than we are, too. So this is part of the reason I give earlier in the book when I talk about why simplicity is important. Well, it's because we're not as smart as we like to think. We don't remember many things. We're a lot busier. And when you add this stuff all together, you end up with a situation where every bit of communication is like a blessing. It's a little miracle, right? And
right.
If we don't acknowledge that, if we think that everybody else is as interested in the thing we have to say as we are, instead of interested in what motivates them, what actually they're interested in terms of their, you know, family and friends and sports teams and work or whatever. If we don't tie what we're saying into their own motivations, well, we're just going to get ignored. Like everything else, there's 13 hours a day the average American spends consuming media. 13 hours a day, it's thousands of messages. There's so many other things to attend to if what you're saying is not interesting. And we often, when we're communicators, if it's a writer or if it's a marketer, we have a really hard time kind of putting that humble hat on a lot of times.
Yeah. And complicated always seems boring, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, complicated is, I argue that, so complicated is dangerous, right? So if you look at the like aviation incidents, fatalities and crashes, if you look at healthcare incidents, if you look at the number one cause of divorce, if you look at the number one cause for fraud, a lot of it results from miscommunication. And so when you're complicated and you fail to connect, you do have a lot at stake when that's the case. I also say, just intrinsically, that complicated is unkind. I would say simplicity is kind, complicated is not. And there's a difference between nice and kind, right? This is something that, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with.
I am, but please share with our listeners, because I love this distinction. I think this is, and I'd love to hear your take on this distinction.
Oh, yeah. So nice is when you care about decorum, is when you care about the surface level. It's when you care about the politeness. It's really when you actually care a little bit more about yourself than when you care about the other party. Kind is when you care about the other party as much or more than you care about yourself. And it's when you care about their outcomes, you care about the actual results, you care about their well-being. And they're not mutually exclusive. You can be nice and kind. But if you can only be one, it's far better to be kind than it is to be nice. An example of this that I love is a couple decades ago, Ed Koch was the mayor. I guess it was a few decades ago. Ed Koch was the mayor of New York. And he had a parking sign, his Department of Transportation had a parking sign that said, don't even think about parking here. It wasn't like a big Byzantine thing of all these little regulations and please don't do this. It was, don't even think about parking here. And sign, I mean, they had like a sequel to it. They sell it in like gift shops and it became this like iconic thing. And it was not very nice, but it was definitely kind because you understood immediately, don't even think about parking here.
You will be towed. You will pay hundreds and hundreds of dollars to get your car back. It's going to suck, right?
And so that's a great example of something that's kind, but it's not necessarily nice. And because of that, I think it's more effective.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And also just even to like in terms of if you're getting marketing help or you're getting book writing help, you definitely don't want the people or branding help for that matter. You don't want the people that are helping you to be nice, right? You want them to be kind and tell you when you are wrong or when you could do something better. So,
oh yeah. I mean, nice feedback doesn't help me. Like this goes back to the kind of empathy thing, which is like, I don't need somebody to tell me to kind of beat around the bush, to tell me this is pretty good when reality, what I need to hear is saying, hey, this part kind of sucks. This part's boring. This part's confusing. That's so much more actionable than me getting the like, oh, I liked it. Yeah, it was pretty good. And that's, you know, I give me the person who's not nice but kind 10 times out of 10.
Absolutely. Especially when you're paying them, right? but in any case, of course. Yeah, so, so true. So I have to know, can you explain for our listeners this idea of beneficial, the whole and not the drill?
Oh, yeah, this is my favorite. So I teach marketing at Baruch College here in New York. I've been an adjunct there for a number of years. And I tell my students, if you remember this sentence, and you forget everything else that you've learned at any point in this education, you will be so far ahead of everybody in marketing, in sales, in business. And it's not mine, so I can't take full credit for it. Theodore Levitt, a Harvard professor from the 60s, he said, people don't want a quarter-inch drill. They want a quarter-inch hole. People don't want a quarter-inch drill. They want a quarter-inch hole. They don't want the thing. They want what the thing does for them. They want the outcome.
Right.
And this is like sales 101, which is people don't buy features, they buy benefits, right? Like yes. If you've ever spent any time in a sales job, you've probably heard this from your boss, your trainer. Features versus benefits. But it's really hard because we will often, when we're communicating, we will see and hear and taste and smell and touch the features. They exist in the real world. They're tangible. But the benefits often aren't, or the benefits are removed from space and time. And so you don't really understand, well, okay, what does it mean that this drill has like longer battery life? You might just go out saying, we have new longer battery life. That doesn't really mean anything. But the thing we want is we want to not have to recharge it as often, is that we can work right. longer or whatever. And yeah. so that's the number one thing. If you can make a shift in how you communicate when you're, especially in a persuasive situation, that mm-hmm. you talk about benefits, not about features.
Yeah. And this is so important too, when authors are writing a book, for example, to grow a business, because people are in love with their own processes, right? And so it's very tempting to want to explain everything about your process and how you came up with it and, you know, what the steps are. Yeah. But really, that's not what your reader cares about so much as what's in it for me. What am I going to get out of going through your process? What's possible for me?
Absolutely. And I have a method, talk about process. I have a method in that chapter where we can kind of help organize our thinking about benefits and features. And it revolves about a very simple, appropriately, question, which is, so what? So what? And the magic is asking it three times. I'll give you an example. Let's talk about toothpaste, right? Let's say you have mint flavor in your toothpaste. That's the feature. Okay, but I don't really want mint toothpaste. What do I want? So what? Well, I want mint toothpaste. So what? Fresh breath. Okay. Mm-hmm. That's the benefit. That's the functional benefit. That's your first level, is that I have fresh breath. Okay, that's great. But do I actually even want fresh breath? So we'll ask it again. I'll say, so what? Well, if I want fresh breath, well, because I'll have a better date tonight. Have a more successful, you know, time, you know, on the dating market or whatever it is. Okay, well, that's maybe your emotional benefit. That's the second layer of it. It starts to get a little less tangible, but it starts to connect a little bit deeper of what your actual goals are. But if you ask it again and you say, well, so what? All of a sudden, you start to reach the actual motivations, the core motivations. Why do you care that you have a good date tonight? Well, you can go to look at kind of Maslow's needs and say, well, it might be your love and belonging needs, might be your physiological needs. Right. And that helps you orient how you're speaking. That gives you kind of the direction of where you want to go.
Yeah.
And then you look back up. We're drilling down and we're going to build back up. And so the build back up is, we say, okay, the date is the emotional benefits. That's going to be maybe our hook. That talking about that is going to be the headline, or it's going to be the first slide, or it's going to be the subject line of our email, something like that. And then we're going to talk about the functional benefits, which is the fresh breath. And that might be the second sentence. That might be the first paragraph in your deck, whatever it is. And then eventually you get to the features. Eventually you describe the mint flavor. And so when you organize it that way, you're connecting with why it is that people make choices and why it is that people buy toothpaste, ultimately, in a way that is much more resonant than if you went out and said, we have a great fresh toothpaste. It smells like, you know, spearmint. Go get it.
Right. You know, as you were talking, I hadn't thought about this in 40 years or 50 years, maybe. But now I'm really dating myself. But I remember a toothpaste called Close Up. And that was exactly their value proposition.
Oh, yeah? That's great.
Yeah. You brushed your teeth so you could kiss somebody. That would be a pleasant
experience.
That's
exactly it, right? And even the, you know, the drill is like, I don't even want the hole. I want the picture on the wall. I don't even want the picture on the wall. It's because I want the love and belonging need, right? Of seeing my family every time I walk down the staircase. That's actually what you want. And it doesn't mean that there's never a time to talk about these other pieces. It's just that in each circumstance, when you identify those, you can invest accordingly. You know, there's going to be times where it makes sense to talk about, if you're speaking to different audiences and different circumstances. You know, if you're having a technical meeting with a supplier somewhere, you're not going to go ahead and talk about these big, you know, motivations. But if you're out there trying to get someone's attention for the first time, that's when that stuff's going to be more important.
Well, and you're also talking about not just benefits, but a hierarchy of benefits of what has the strongest emotional pull, right? Because if you were selling it to dentists, you might talk about the quality of the fluoride or something, right? And how it penetrates the enamel better or something like, you know, so it's interesting that it's really about the motivation of what the buyer really wants and writing directly to that first. And that's what opens the door for them to also get, oh yeah, and it protects my teeth from cavities.
You know, oh yeah.
Like meeting them, and like we were talking about meeting them where they are. Yeah.
Oh yeah. And the reason this becomes so challenging is because bigger companies, older companies, more bureaucracy, it becomes really challenging for them to talk about benefits, because the further you get away from that kind of spark that led the innovation or to write the book or whatever, well, the features stay visible, but the benefits no longer are as present, because then you're not solving that problem for yourself as much anymore. If you look at like Microsoft, when they spoke about Microsoft Excel when it came out a few decades ago, it was pretty great. They were really compelling about it. They're talking about all the things you can do and how it would change your business and all this great stuff. And if you look today, they just talk about like, go download Excel, you know, go download Excel. Right. Yeah, like great.
Go get it. You'll love it.
Yeah.
That is really true. So what I'm hearing is that brands can reach a point, or even products inside of brands can reach a point where they're so ubiquitous in a way, or they're just so commonplace that it becomes more and more difficult to get people enrolled, or how would you put it? I want to really get the point of what you're going with here. Yeah.
As you get bigger, as you get older, as you get more kind of layered and bureaucratic, you will be further away from the benefits, but you'll stay always the same distance from the features. So it's really hard to, it becomes harder and harder rather to focus on the benefits because they're further and further away. And that ends up being the reason why a lot of companies can be disrupted by upstarts who are closer to the customers. That's one of many reasons, but it's an important piece, is that if you don't understand, if you're not empathetic about your readers, your customers, whoever, well, you're going to start to lose out to people who aren't.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And the up and coming people who are doing the innovating are probably also more in touch with the present day customer.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
You know, I'm thinking Netflix Blockbuster or Kodak Digital. You know, some of those major disruptions that are way overwritten about, but just as food for thought. Hi there, Robin here. Have you been considering writing a thought leadership book that grows your business? How about writing a quality, standout book with a real book publishing deal behind it that not only grows your business, but also grows your influence and reach? In case you're new to the Author's Corner, my name is Robin Colucci, and I help world-class experts write world-changing books that get published. With over 30 years of experience in the publishing industry, I have helped clients write and publish books with Big Five and other top publishers. Many have gone on to become bestsellers, from Amazon all the way up to the New York Times. And others have increased their business income 600 times or more as a result of their book and partnering with me and my team. If you are a top-notch expert who is ready to write your world-changing book, go schedule a free consultation call with one of my trusted team members today. We have a limited number of slots available, and we only take clients who are committed to the process and want to get their book started now. If that sounds like you, go to www.worldchangingbooks.com/application. to apply for one of our exclusive spots. Once again, that link is worldchangingbooks.com/application. Now, back to the show. So we touched upon this, but I'd like to go a little bit deeper into this idea of, because we do live in such a busy, noisy world, it seems to me that simplicity has got to be more important than ever. But I'd love to hear you expound upon that a bit and hear what you have to say.
Oh, I mean, it's one of those things that it's not like a particularly like hot take or insightful thing for me to say that we're busy, right? Like I mentioned the 13 hours before that the average American spends on media. You know, when I ask my students every semester. I say, well, how often do you use your phone or how many hours? And, you know, they say one number. And then I'm like, actually, everybody open up your settings and then just look at the number there and let's shout those out. I get things that are 8 hours, 7 hours, 6 hours, and I'm not immune to it. I think mine was like 4 hours and 30 minutes last week. So I mean, it's plenty of time on the phone. You see in the market, you see people downloading ad blockers, downloading meditation apps, downloading all these things to kind of start to filter out some of the noise. These platforms like Apple and Google have both been, as well as Mozilla, other places, have both been rolling out features and software that allow people to limit their screen time or limit what, you know, how much time they spend on the web in different places. So it's not something that, you know, it's just kind of me noticing it for sure. But also what's interesting, to put it all in context, is that it's also not something particularly new. If you look back in every generation, there's been people talking about how kids these days, you know, all they do is, you know, they're on their phone. Oh, they're on their computer. Oh, they're on the TV. Oh, they're on the radio. Oh, they read too many newspapers. Oh, they read too many books. Oh, you know, and like, it's been going on forever. But it would be foolish to think that this is exactly the same as all of that, because it does feel like we're in a bit more of a period of acceleration when it comes to how our attention is licensed.
Yeah. And I see so many people who are like sitting together, but all staring at their phones. So
oh, yeah, I've done that. I mean,
I've done it too.
And you're like, I'll sit down next to my wife on the couch and we'll both be scrolling separately. And like,
Yeah. So there is definitely a lot more. There's clearly a lot more opportunities for distraction that are maybe flashier distractions, right? Than staring at a tree, for example, which I find to be a lovely distraction as well.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the thing is, now we have the science and the data that helps us become really good at capturing people's attention, right? And, you know, people, they'll use this for nefarious purposes, maybe, right? Or, trying to trick you into buying something you don't need or want, or voting for some candidate that's not helping you, or whatever it is. And so that's something I want to be as conscious as possible about in this. I like to say that, you know, marketing is neutral. It can be used for either, you know, for good or for bad. And it's just important that, this is a thing I talked about in my class before, I try to make sure I spend time every semester on too, which is that it is neutral, but it's often misused. And you have to individually, you know, as an industry and as an individually, you have to spend time to make sure that you're using, you know, your powers for good, for lack of a better term, right? And there's plenty of like propagandists and whatever that use the type of tools we're talking about in this book. But just like my model when I was putting this together was Influence by Robert Cialdini, who that's like a famous marketing book from a couple of decades back. And that book's been kind of co-opted by a lot of people saying, hey, this is how I persuade people. This is how I kind of, you know, trick people into doing something. But if you read the book and over again, he's saying, this is how you can defend yourself from this stuff. This is how you can use this stuff for good, not using it just for personal gain. So that was the model I was looking at when I was putting everything here together.
Yeah, and all very important to be aware of, and also to be aware of when people are telling you things and promising you things, to interrogate those messages as well and look at other sources and make sure that you are being given good information.
One last thing. Complicated is also selfish, I argue, because you can use complicated and the result of it, which is that people zone out, they don't pay attention, to hide all sorts of things that you don't want people to see or to hear or to know. Just look at the terms of use that you get for every piece of software that you've ever used in your entire life. There are thousands and thousands of words. I hate to pick on Microsoft too much, but I think theirs is like 30,000 words or something for the end user license agreement. And it covers all sorts of things that are not the most savory policies. And so this is a perfect example of complicated gives you room to hide. And simplicity is challenging because it doesn't, but it's also more effective for that same purpose.
Well, I have to add to that now that you've brought that up, because I don't, you know, Apple has a similar, their terms of use are also very, very long. I don't know if you ever saw that South Park episode where I think it was Cartman signed the terms of use, and something that is reminiscent of the movie Centipede happened to him and his friends. I'll leave it at that. You can all find the episode, but it was gross and funny. So on that note, Ben, I cannot believe how close we are to the top of the hour here. So why don't I throw you my final question, which is, What have I not asked you today that you would love to answer?
Oh, boy. I would say something completely different besides the book, because like, what, seen any good movies lately? It's funny because we talk about books, we talk about marketing, and that's how we connect. Is that I in my old agency, we used to run, we did a lot of book marketing. And one thing that it's hard to understand until you're in it is that you often end up talking about the same thing, like over and over and over and over again. And I've told people that I've spoken to recently who were thinking about writing that you have to write something that you feel that you can talk about 1,000 times, because you're going to have to talk about it 1,000 times. If it's on a podcast, if you're writing an article, if it's with somebody you meet at a cocktail party or whatever, you're going to have to explain, what about this? What about that? And if it becomes a chore to you, you're going to hate the process of writing it and of having written it. But if you enjoy it and it's something deep enough and wide enough, kind of hits that sweet spot, you're going to have a much better time. So that was, the joke that I said, about like seeing any good movies lately is like, because I've heard the other questions about things a lot. And this has been a really wonderful conversation because we've explored a bunch of new areas. But it's interesting when you can begin to connect it into spaces that weren't what you kind of put in the manuscript, and it starts to take a life of its own. So that's
give me an example of where you see this, where you've seen this simplicity really effectively handled in a film recently. I'd love to hear that.
Oh, in a film, that's a good question. It's funny. This is particularly top of mind. I don't know if it's simple, but I saw the new Godzilla movie last night. And so I am such as a kid, I watched a ton of Godzilla movies. Uh-huh. They're just great. They're kind of mindless a lot of times, but some of them are really like deep allegories for different societal issues. This one was a pretty good one in that regard, but it was just so good. And it was, what was nice about it was it didn't try to be anything it wasn't. So talk about, there's a slight connection there to simplicity, is that it knew what the plot was. It kept the characters tight. It kept the pacing up, and it understood the assignment, which is, what people want to see when they go to see a Godzilla movie is they want to see Godzilla. They want to see him playing battleships and walking around a city and using his lasers. And so it understood, what was the motivation for somebody to go see the movie. It's, there are directors out there who saw Jaws and took the lesson away, which is you should never show the monster. You should never show the shark. And that is a good way to tell a story, certainly. But that's not the way to tell a Godzilla story. People want to see the monster.
That's for sure.
So that's an example of kind of understanding the audience.
Love it. Well, Ben, this has been so much fun. And I want to thank you again for being with us on the Author's Corner.
Likewise. Thanks so much, Robin.
Thank you for tuning in to another amazing episode of The Author's Corner. You're one step closer to writing the world-changing book you've dreamed about for years. To access today's show notes and other helpful resources, simply visit our website at theauthorscorner.com. A positive review would be appreciated. Until next time.